In an ice-cold December, she turns to the one person she can trust to help. But his heart is as frozen as the ice. A troubled past and uncertain future brings them reluctantly back together. But will the warmth of Christmas melt away their fears? I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome, readers and romance seekers, to our Christmas special. I hope you are having a lovely Christmas Eve tonight. And so, as a special gift to all of you, we are taking a look at Lord Grantwell's Christmas Wish by Diane Gaston. We are back with Harlequin Historical with this particular selection, and it takes place during the Regency era in England. We've been here before. Episodes 5 and 6 introduced us to the Regency setting, albeit in very different ways. Considering a wolf in Duke's clothing is on the Gold Star shelf, Lord Grantwell's Christmas Wish has some big shoes to fill. I do want to check in with the author before we get started. According to Fantastic Fiction, Diane Gaston has been writing since 2003, and from the looks of things, she writes almost exclusively historical romance, mostly set within the Regency era. Her own website looks like it could use some work, though. Had I not checked in with Fantastic Fiction, I would have thought that she only had published two books, Christmas Wish and Her Gallant Captain at Waterloo. Both of these are within the same series, though only this one is Christmas-themed. A few of her novels seem to have a military slant, but that's not a surprise given that she basically grew up as an army brat. What I also find interesting is punctuation, the format within the book itself. Christmas Wish reads as if it were published in England, though Gaston is an American writer from what I can tell. I'm guessing that she has a contract first with Mills and Boone, the English hat of Harlequin Enterprises. And then the book is brought to North America without localizing the production and the punctuation. I'd be curious to know if Gaston submits her manuscripts with American or English punctuation. But that's all besides the point. We are here for a romantic Regency Christmas, so that's what we are going to get. So turn on your holiday Yule log of choice, pour a cup of hot chocolate, and pick out some Christmas cookies, and we can get started. Our cover is, well, somewhat plain. It's a man and a woman in historical dress, chastely holding each other in an embrace. The woman is wearing a red velvet gown, and our gentleman is wearing a blue jacket. Because I still know nothing about historical Regency fashion, short of sending unsolicited mail to Bernadette Banner, I can't vouch for the accuracy. What does catch my eye, however, is that there's a wedding ring on the woman's finger. I don't think that I've ever seen one of those on our covers, and its inclusion does raise a few eyebrows. The couple blocks most of the room that they're standing in, but it looks like what I would expect a historical set to look like. And there are tiny hints of red ribbon and holly to suggest our Christmas theme. Well, I'm hoping that it's red ribbon and holly. It's hard to tell. Because if it's poinsettias, that will lose the cover a lot of points, since the book takes place in 1817, and to the best of my knowledge, poinsettias didn't make it to England until at least 1834. But my Christmas pedantry aside, we can now make our way onto the story. We begin with John Grantwell, known as Grant, quoting Shakespeare when faced with a blizzard on his estate. He was formerly a captain of the East Essex Regiment, now Vicomte, having inherited the title from his brother over a year ago when his brother died. I always appreciate a good Shakespeare quote, but the Vicomte has a lot on his mind. Not only has he had to drag his lands back from ruin after his brother's poor management, but now he has to manage his brother's quote-unquote children as well. It's a bit more complicated than that, though. His brother George married a woman who also died with the brother, and she'd already had two kids before the marriage. Quite the scandal, you see. And the poor children had been shipped off to live with their maternal grandfather until he died, and they were sent to Grant only a week before our story begins. So while the children are technically Grant's niece and nephew by marriage, there is no blood relation, and all evidence points to the kids having an awful childhood. After a moment when Grant catches the kids in one of the Secret Servant passageways, his butler Thompson arrives with the news that a woman has arrived to apply for the position of a governess for the kids. It is a surprise to Grant, since they had only just asked for inquiries. His surprise turns to shock and dismay when he lays eyes on the newcomer. God save him, she was as beautiful as ever. Hair dark as night, eyes like warm chocolate, nose regal, lips naturally pursed as if always ready for a kiss. But she was unusually pale and thin. Her clothes hung on her and he could smell their dampness from the melted snow. He knew her as Lillian Karras. He'd made her acquaintance when attending entertainments with the Portuguese aristocrats who'd remained in Portugal after Prince John and other members of the royal family fled to Brazil. She was widowed, she told him, and their affair had been as torrid as that winter had been cold. Until she had stolen from him, and almost succeeding in committing treason on his country and hers. So, clearly, we have some baggage to unpack. The story goes, Lillian met up with Grant while he was out fighting for king and country, and they got hot and heavy whenever they could. But one day, when Grant had some sensitive documents in his possession, said documents were stolen, and only by sheer luck and dogged persistence, disaster was avoided on the part of the English army. Lillian was implicated in the theft, and they all learned that she was not actually widowed. Her husband had apparently survived whatever ailed him to the point of practically death, much to her surprise. That is, until he actually did die, and evidence of his death was again linked to Lillian. So now she's fled, being pursued by her brother-in-law for a crime that she claims she did not commit. And Grant is not having it. He is all but ready to throw her out, but she doesn't have money for a carriage or an inn, and the snow is becoming nearly impassable. Now, as he is a romantic hero, we won't suffer Grant to be a total monster, and he's not. He says begrudgingly that she can stay, so long as she remains far from him. So in short, this is a mess. And despite everything, her past and current situation, we can see that Lillian still feels for Grant. Her handsome Grant. The mere sight of him had made her errant body come alive with desire. He was every bit as tall and muscular as she remembered, with his dark curly hair and lean face. His expressive brows framed changeable hazel eyes that appeared gray this day, like storm clouds. At least he'd not smiled. His smile, like sunshine on a crisp spring day, would have been impossible to resist. He'd always been smiling during those wonderful days when they were together. Still, she yearned for that smile. Standing in the hallway, taking stock of what to do once she left Grant's home, she hears a child's cry and a young boy calling for help. This is how we meet the children, William, the older brother, and Anna, the younger sister. Anna had a fall, and William, being the protective brother, was calling for help. Lillian is already soothing the girl when Grant and a maid, Hannah, arrive. Grant tries to help, but William won't let him near his sister, which is adorable in a way. It also helps establish a bit of our dynamic and what we can expect from the story to come. Obviously, the kids are not fond of Grant. They've only been there a week, but no one seems to have warmed up to anyone. In enters Lillian, to whom the children immediately take a shine. It's stated that Lillian doesn't have a lot of experience with children, except the ones at her old boarding school, but clearly she is a natural with the kids. We can see, obviously, that the kids will ask if Lillian can stay for the Christmas holiday, because they already adore her, and Grant will have no choice but to acquiesce, if only to stop the cycle of denial and neglect that they have been living with up until this moment. So it remains to be seen whether or not she'll actually get to stay until Christmas. That tends to be how these stories go, right? My prediction is that something massive will set off our third act separation, albeit a problem between Grant and Lillian or Lillian's past catching up with her, and it'll be a race to settle things before Christmas Day itself. To be perfectly honest, I am already stressed thinking about that pressure. After a soothing snack of cookies and milk, here they are called biscuits, but I am an American, so I'm calling them cookies, Lillian is taken to the room where she will be staying, and eventually her hunger gets the best of her. On her way to find the kitchen to persuade the cook to make her something, she runs into the dining room where she finds Grant. Despite his coldness, again, we cannot have a complete ogre of a romantic hero, so he invites her to join him for dinner, but it's still a strained affair. He tells her a little bit about the children's upbringing, and she offers to help them while she's there. It's understood that she will not be staying, but she is willing to earn her keep. And through it all, Grant can feel his old attraction for her stirring. It is a complicated situation, to be sure. At the end of dinner, Grant asks why she is still wearing wet clothing, and she admits that everything she had with her was soaked in the snow. This prompts him to offer clothing borrowed from the house, once belonging to his late sister-in-law. I'll admit that in other settings, this might set off a creep alarm in my mind, but even among the wealthy, a general historical attitude is very much waste not, want not. Besides, from what I've gathered, the sister-in-law in question was not well liked, so really it's probably more of a matter of, well, it's not like she can say anything about it. They part for the evening, and alone with his thoughts, Grant goes over in his mind with Lillian's possible motives. He believed that she truly was attempting to commit treason, that she was a spy for the French, even though she's vehemently denied it. But their dinner together is chipping away at those suspicions. The next morning, Lillian is woken by the maid so that she can begin the work of caring for Anna and William. Everyone in the house agrees that the two are mini-hellions, but somehow I get the feeling that they won't cause a lick of trouble for our dear Lillian. Shy about asking for fun activities, the kids mention how nice it would be to play out in the snow, but they never got much of a chance to play before. Immediately, Lillian suggests they do exactly that, and of course they come across Grant, who is returning from seeing his grounds manager. The inevitable snowball fight ensues, and more of the family dynamic begins to take shape. While the kids were hesitant around him at first, they're starting to warm up to Grant, and Grant is also proving himself adept around the kids. Through the snowballs, a visit to the kitchens for warm milk and honey, and a small bit of playtime, we learn more and more about how Anna and William were emotionally neglected by their former family. That's not to say that they didn't get any affection. There was a governess and a footman who were fond of the kids, but their grandfather treated them as ornaments for his parties and then insisted that they stay out of sight for all other moments. We expect Lillian to catch on quick, since it's clear she's filling a caretaker role, and she has a background with the same sort of similar situation. And Grant isn't stupid either. He can tell when his words hit a chord with the children, and when Lillian comes to him, asking permission to go through small scraps and attic dust collectors so the children can make Christmas gifts, he is happy to oblige. Clearly, he is still trying to keep Lillian at a distance, but he's not going to let it get in the way of the children's comfort. We will forget that Lillian is a suspected murderer, and Grant seems all right with leaving his charges in her care, but who's keeping track, right? I will also note that there's a lot of, let's say, expected gender roles all over the place here in this novel. It is expected, given the time period and the setting, but knowing that going in, William is going to go gaga for toy soldiers and Anna is going to embroider everything. While helping the children begin their work on presents, they ask Lillian where she's going to go when she leaves, and on a whim, she tells them Scotland. This is how she finds herself running into Grant in the library, looking for a book on Scotland, reminding him that she cannot be trusted. Trusting or not, some things cannot be forgotten. Lillian gasped as if in fright and jumped into his arms. What? He held her with his free arm as the lamp illuminated the next room, the sculpture gallery. She pulled away from him and gave an embarrassed laugh. Oh, they are statues. I thought I glimpsed a real person. He was unprepared for her instinctive leap towards him, as if wanting him to protect her. It's a little bit of a metaphorical moment, but it also serves to show that the rift between our two lovers is not completely impassable. we have some hope. The next day, we find the children and Lillian playing outside once again, this time making more snow people. Grant calls the work sculpture, which prompts the children to ask about the stone people, which in turn prompts a proper tour of the house for the kids. The past neglect is showing through again. William and Anna weren't permitted free run of their grandfather's house, so it'll be one more step to bringing them into the household, truly. When they get to the sculpture room, or the stone people as they now begin to call them, there is a rather amusing conversation with the children regarding the lack of clothing on the Roman statues. In a very go-ask-your-mom moment, Grant puts Lillian on the spot to explain why the statues have their terms and conditions hanging out. The Greeks and Romans thought the human body was beautiful to behold, so modesty was not important to them. She glanced at the statue of Hercules, but was only reminded of Grant, magnificent in his nakedness, muscles firm and rippling, his male parts a thrill. If Hercules was meant to depict perfection, the Romans had never seen the likes of Grant 7 years ago. I'm glad that the book isn't exactly dancing around the idea of sex between our two lovers, given the time period. This could be really easily rather stifling, but so far, I think it's a nice balance. The only rub comes when Grant is swinging between, "Oh my god, she is so hot," to, "But she's also a traitor's bitch," quick enough to give me whiplash. Thankfully, he's starting to question what he thinks and is trying to judge her based on her actions. Their tour takes them to the children's mother's old room. I realize that was a mouthful, but if I say the late Lady Grantwell, it makes it sound like Grant is a widow instead of it being his sister-in-law. It's honestly a challenging situation overall, and the children clearly do not have fond memories of their mother. The room contains a large portrait of their mother, and it puts them in a solemn mood. Grant quickly picks up on it and shows William mementos from his time in the armory, considering the boy is soldier crazy. Unfortunately, that night, Lillian hears a commotion when William wakes up from a nightmare. He runs to his mother's room, attempting to drag his mother's portrait off the wall. Grant catches up, soothes the boy, promising that first thing tomorrow they would remove the painting and store it deep in the attic. When the children are settled again for the night, Grant and Lillian walk slowly away from their bedroom. A small bonding moment later, and then they cannot keep their hands off each other. Hilariously, Grant asks where Lillian's room is, because I suppose the house is that large. In the room, they do not waste any time whatsoever. A hurried undressing, and boom, they are knocking boots. Something that I've noticed a lot of in these books. We don't really take the time to warm the ladies up, do we? They are already primed for whatever the guy wants, and hardly ever have I seen any instance of foreplay for our women. Please note that higher-rated selections tend to have those moments that I'm looking for, but for a majority of these books that we've read, it can be very much insert tab A into slot B. There is a statistic, I think, that we all need to know about, and it's almost sad that many folks don't know about it. Between 20 and 25% of women are able to orgasm only during vaginal intercourse. That means no other stimulation, just simple penetration. For the rest of us, we need a few other ingredients, as it were. That can vary between person to person, but the statistic stands. And yet, over and over, I read these books, and the majority of women just go off like firecrackers the moment their man enters them. Were it so easy. There's a lot that I could extrapolate from this particular data point, but alas, I am neither a demographics professional or a sexual psychologist, so I might leave it alone for now. I'll probably get into my tinfoil theories next week, but for behind the page. For now, though, let it be said that I don't believe the sexual disparity between book and reality suggests anything good. So getting back to our story, where Lillian has come with only the magical power of the captain's penis, we continue. Grant leaves her room, telling himself that it was a bad idea to get into her bed and resolving to keep her distance from here on out until she's gone, a resolve that lasts approximately 8 hours. She approaches him as he's eating breakfast, and while he's waiting for the shoe to drop, she doesn't mention their night. Instead, she asks if she can stay until after Christmas, simply so the children don't have one more thing to upset their holiday. And she also asks if there is a staff member who can accompany her and the children to collect evergreens to decorate the house. It's hilarious to think that it's 2 days to Christmas and they haven't done any major decorating yet. But we also have to remember that this is a different time. Christmas was the beginning of the festivities. The 12 days of Christmas exists for a reason. Grant agrees to both and worries like any man would that she didn't totally fawn over him and then the night that they spent together. For her part, Lillian is doing her best to keep cool, if only so she doesn't disrupt the house too much. Grant gathers the things that he can, hoping that he can foist the Evergreen expedition on someone else, but it seems that fate is resolved to keep him and Lillian together. He alerts his estate manager, Riss Landon, who in turn gets the sleigh ready. I will pause to mention that Riss is the romantic hero from the previous book in this series. He and Grant were compatriots during the war, and now they work together on Grant's estate. The whole lot of them, Grant, Lillian, Riss, and the children all go out on the sleigh to meet up with Grant's woodsmen, and they begin the work of selecting the best evergreens that they can find. And of course, we can't have a traditional Christmas story without mistletoe. They find bunches of the little parasitic plant, and of course have to include it in the decorations. They return to the house, and while Lillian gets the kids settled after their adventure, she gets into her mind to find them some Christmas gifts. She runs up to the attic, where of course she finds Grant and the butler, making sure his promise about the portrait is fulfilled. They keep running into each other so much that I'm starting to wonder if they're being controlled in some way. Together, she and Grant look over the attic, finally finding a doll for Anna and Grant's old tin soldier set for William, among other toys the two children can both enjoy together. Grant then invites her and the kids to Christmas Eve dinner, after which she and Grant can wrap gifts once the kids are asleep. They are all summoned by Grant Christmas Eve morning, where he insists that they decorate the house with the evergreens and the mistletoe. It is a delightful morning, but undercut with some sadness on Lillian's part. She hasn't had very many nice Christmases, and all things considered, this Christmas will likely be the nicest she is going to have in a long time. It's all that she can do to keep happy for William and Anna. Grant, on the other hand, is slowly warming to the idea that Lillian has told the truth all those years ago. He has decided that not only will she be present at Christmas dinner with Riss and his wife, but also with Anna and William, so they won't have to spend another Christmas locked away like they were a shameful secret. With Christmas on the literal horizon, Lillian knows her welcome will be overworn, so with a bittersweet heart, she accepts Grant's invitation to join on the Christmas Day festivities. It's been a real treat reading this book, as a matter of fact. I might what I consider a fool for Christmas, and take great delight in all the old stories and traditions of the Yuletide. For more than one reason, Christmas is near and dear to my heart, so reading about this little proto-family navigating Christmas traditions is quite endearing. During gift-giving and festive frolicking, Grant insists on the children calling him Uncle Grant rather than the stiff Lord Grantwell, and Grant gives them one more present. Lillian may stay until Twelfth Night, also known as Epiphany. If I remember correctly, Twelfth Night was the big day during this time period, given its association to the kings arriving at the feet of the Christ child. Our modern Christmas can seem a little removed from its religious background, at least here in the States, so not a lot of folks here think about Epiphany. To risk a tangent, this is why the 12 days of Christmas is the way it is. The gift-giving begins on December 25th with a tiny little bird in a pear tree, and ends on Epiphany with a literal hullabaloo of dancers and drummers. Anyway, for dinner, Lillian gets dressed in the best gown the closet had to offer. The kids are delighted to see her, and they all go down to dinner after William reassures Anna that it's all right to be joining Grant's guests. We get another moment with Riss, and we also meet his wife Helen. Like I mentioned before, these were the previous book couple, and I'm not sure how much time has passed, since they met while Riss and Grant were still on the battlefield, and now they've got one baby, with another on the way. And as far as I know, it was not a Christmas novel. Helen seems pretty sharp. She can tell that Anna was nervous at dinner and made sure the little girl wasn't left out. Then she's able to pin the problem between Grant and Lillian, even if she doesn't know all of the details. She acts as the outsider, the person who can see the bigger picture when the people involved can't get their sight beyond their noses. And Riss as well. When the women are having tea after the kids are being put to bed, Grant gets the, you know you're totally in love with her, talk from Riss, but that's what friends are for. When the evening's done and the guests are gone, Grant walks Lillian to her room. They are oddly at peace with one another, but sure that they also want another night together. Something that I'm not surprised to see is the soldier's scars moment. I've seen this a time or two when veterans are involved. There's usually some mention, after the undressing but before the sex, of battle scars acquired in their service. She fingered one of them, just under his ribcage. What happened here?
A French saber, he responded, his voice languid, as if it were a trifle. At Salamanca, not deep enough to do any real harm.
She leaned down and kissed it. What happened to the French soldier?
My sword went deeper.
I'm not a veteran, and I don't personally know very many combat veterans, so I'm not sure how this is seen within the community. On one hand, it can be a validating moment, where the scars are not considered a detriment to the partner in question. On the other, it can be invasive, forcing the partner to relive things that they don't want to remember. So, without having any baseline for this concept, I'm going to leave it be for the moment. But I can appreciate my sword went deeper. Some good old dry British humor. The next day is St. Stephen's Day, or Boxing Day to us Yanks. Grant and the kids run around giving gifts to the household staff, and Lillian does chores for Hannah. After it all, Grant gives a coin purse to Lillian so that she might have something to sustain her when she finally leaves the estate. We all know that it won't be so easy, though. One of Grant's staff, a man named Smith, comes up to the house, nearly frozen in the snow. He brings news of two stranded travelers in their carriage, and Lillian knows exactly who these two men could be. William helps Grant receive the travelers when they make it to the house, and when they are out of earshot, Grant very sternly warns William not to mention Lillian at all to them, and to tell her to stay as hidden as possible. When the young boy relays this information to her, she asks if he saw the family crest on their things. He describes a lion, and she knows that it's the crest belonging to her late husband's family. So she does something that I really can't fault her for, but also want to yell at her for, and runs. Can't blame her. They think she murdered her husband, and in this day and age, a fair trial is probably anything but for a widowed woman. I would run too. Grant manages to catch up to her, thankfully, and stashes her at Riss and Helen's house. Now we get to meet our pursuers, the Baron de Coval, known as Dennis, and Santos, the servant. It looks as though Dennis is in rough health, and Santos is totally devoted to him. And between you and me, if we were all playing a game of Among Us, Santos is sus. Once Grant returns to the house, he makes sure that all of the staff and household members know to keep mum as far as Lillian is concerned. When he goes to meet his new guests, they dance around the subject for a moment and they finally ask him if he knows anything about Lillian. He puts on a show, not unlike the one we saw at the beginning of the novel, where he all but curses her name. The Baron doesn't seem to know what to think, but Santos isn't buying it. At the end of the day, Grant goes back out to Riss's house to check on Lillian, where he finally tells her that he trusts what she says, and that he will ensure that no harm comes to her. But I've read enough of these to know that something bad is about to go down. The next morning, Santos gets more than one runaround by the servants. They insist that they can care for the Baron's things while they're there, and Santos is pressing that it must be him. And while the staff is standoffish, he still manages to get in a lay of the land, including knowledge of Anna and William. Grant gets a check-in from the staff and the kids while in the kitchen. Things are tense. Santos is basically trying to bribe the staff into giving him information. They've all denied everything, of course, and the kids have been spying on him using those secret servant passageways. Grant thanks them all, tells the kid to stop spying for their safety,
and urges them all to hold out until the men are gone. He then checks on the two interlopers and tells Santos to quit it, and Santos resolves to see where Grant has been going in those evenings. We have to admit, Grant was a little stupid to think that he wouldn't be found out if he kept going outside. And of course, Lillian finds herself face to face with Santos after he had crept oh so quietly into her room at Riss and Helen's home. She tells him that she will scream for help, but then he shows her a tin soldier and a small wooden doll. He insinuates that William and Anna will be harmed or killed if she does not comply with his demands, the first of which is to return with him to the main estate, and the second is to confess to the murder of her husband and any plot of treachery she was accused of in front of Dennis and Grant. With the children's lives at stake, she has no choice. Back at the house, in the presence of both her former brother-in-law and Grant, she says what Santos demands. But when urged to repeat herself, she gets clever with her words.
"Repeat yourself, Senora," the servant insisted. "Show the Baron and Lord Grantwell precisely who you are."
"I lied before." She turned her head and gazed directly at Grant. "Everything I said was a lie." Grant is still too blindsided to understand the subtext in her words, and he does not immediately believe her. Lillian knows that she is likely going to die back in Portugal or wherever Dennis decides to take his justice, but at least she's going with the knowledge that she admitted what she could to Grant in a way that he would hopefully understand one day. Luckily for Lillian, though, Grant didn't immediately catch on. It's clear that his heart broke at her words, but Santos is smart enough to know what she had tried to do. He drags her off to another room, to gloat, I suppose, as they wait for their next move. Lillian can't fully accept the situation, however. She knows that she's innocent of any wrongdoing, so why wouldn't Santos or Dennis even stop to consider that possibility? Then it hits her. Santos was the one who killed her husband, and Santos was the one who framed her for treason. I'm not exactly sure why, but he had his reasons and his ambitions, as he says. And just as Lillian gets him to admit it, she sees a crack in the wall and two young faces peering in. She fails to draw Santos's attention away from the kids, and he chases after them in the servants' passage. It's that moment that Grant, having fled to drown his sorrows in a glass of brandy, gets the clue that Lillian hurled at him, and hears the commotion in the passage. Running to the rescue of them all, he pushes Santos down a flight of stairs and holds Lillian tight, telling her that he finally believes her. Things wrap up pretty quick. Santos is apprehended, awaiting trial, and the small blended family can all finally come together with no barriers between them. Our epilogue takes us a year later, on another Christmas Eve. Grant has hired the two beloved servants from the home where Anna and William had come from, and the family has come together to light a Yule log. Grant and Lillian are married, and they have a baby on the way. It's a nice little ending, and does add to our happy story, so I don't have any complaints about this epilogue tonight. And we have come to the end of Lord Grantwell's Christmas Wish. Was it everything that we had hoped for? Well, let's think on it a bit. For what it is, I thought it was a delightful little story. The contrivance that brought our couple together was a tad convoluted, but when we mix historical fiction with a somewhat military setting, it can get a little convoluted anyway. And I really don't know anything about the Napoleonic Wars, so I don't feel like my sense of disbelief was stretched to its limits. As for the Christmas aspect, I was having a blast looking up at all the little traditions that were featured during the Regency era. I'm more familiar with the Christmas traditions from the Victorian age and beyond, so it was a real treat. But these are not why we read the book. We were here for a romance. So without further ado, let's get into Heather's final score. As usual, we start with the cover, and our cover is going to get a 4 out of 5. I don't have much more to say about it than I already did, except that it could have had a little bit more Christmas added in. Nothing overblown, of course, but the little touches that were added in look very obviously to be last-minute additions. drama is a 3 out of 5. It really is in the middle. I felt as though it didn't show up until the very last tenth of the novel, and any conflict was really just a stressful dance of can I trust her, constantly from Grant. If we take that out, we get a very basic lost lovers found plot, and their separation could have been caused by anything. The addition of the children just smooths out any wrinkles between our two lovers, and the kids are practically the glue that holds them together, which isn't exactly a good thing. And that brings me to romance. This was hard because it wasn't much romance as it was. They clearly had a bad separation, but they also still clearly had the hots for each other. There wasn't a lot that I saw between them that indicated that they would be a good couple, except for how they interacted with the kids. It was the kids that brought life into the novel, and without them, I'm not sure how Lillian and Grant would have fared. I'm giving Spice a very expected 2 out of 5. They had more than one night together, sure, and every chance that they get, they are nearly electric with the need to touch one another, but that's about it. They clearly have chemistry, but we've seen all of this before. Realism is getting a 3 out of 5. I can see the first half of this concept, lost lovers found, bonding together over a blended family, playing out in any novel or any kind of media. It's something that happens every day in real life, and many of us can relate to this story. The rest of it, however, with the treason and the suspected murder, is where it gets a little squirrely. If Grant truly believed that Lillian was the villain that she thought she was, he would have locked her in the attic until the roads were clear and booted her out the door. Letting her near Anna and William is not a great idea given that background. And when we add in the scheming manservant, yeah, it's a little too much. But despite all that, it's a perfectly nice, heartwarming Christmas novel. Did it come up to the standard set in our score? Debatable. But did we get a Christmas romance? We sure as sugar did. And that's what matters in the end. Did we get the story we asked for when picking up the book off the shelf? With that in mind, Lord Grantwell's Christmas Wish gets 4 mistletoe kisses out of 5. I wish you and yours a very Merry Christmas, so stay warm and stay merry. Thank you so much for joining me, readers and romance seekers, to the special holiday edition. And I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hyun Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read. Only that it is what you love.